the headlines. A top U.S. senator says the situation in Afghanistan is the result of years of policy and intelligence failures as Washington steps up evacuation from Kabul. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says the U.S. failure in Afghanistan shows that Washington's regional policies are miscalculated and ignorant. Also coming up, Haitian authorities say the death toll from Saturday's major earthquake in the Caribbean country has jumped to nearly 2,000. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the U.S. State Department says Washington has completed a drawdown of its embassy personnel from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
Our team is working hand in glove with military colleagues to help load planes safely and securely and as fast as possible. We've now completed our drawdown to the core diplomatic presence we need, and at this time we will no longer need to facilitate departures for our embassy personnel.
Ned Price said the remaining embassy staff are assisting the evacuation of American citizens and Afghan allies. Meanwhile, members of the U.S. Congress vowed to investigate President Joe Biden's administration over the collapse of the Afghan government and the rise of the Taliban to power. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Menendez, described what's happened in Afghanistan as the horrifying result of many years of policy and intelligence failures. He said the recent developments were the culmination of a series of mistakes made by Republican and Democratic administrations over the past 20 years. The European Union says the Taliban have won the war, so the bloc has to engage in dialogue with them.
I haven't said that we are going to recognize the Taliban. I just said that we have to talk with them for everything, even to try to protect women and girls. Even for that, we have to get in touch with them.
Joseph Borrell said the bloc had miscalculated the military capabilities of the Afghan army against the Taliban. He noted that the EU's priority at the moment is to evacuate European nationals and Afghan citizens who have been working with them over the past 20 years. According to Borrell, preventing a possible influx of migrants into the EU is another issue high on the bloc's agenda. Meanwhile, Germany says it will judge the Taliban by their actions.
We'll need to see what to think of this in the next few days. We have also discussed this today in the Foreign Council of the European Union and have come to the conclusion that we will judge the Taliban by their actions.
The German Foreign Minister stressed the significance of a peaceful power transition in Afghanistan. He said Berlin will evaluate the situation after the new Afghan government is installed. Also, the United Nations said it's awaiting action from the Taliban on the pledges it has made. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, however, said his country won't recognize a Taliban government in Afghanistan. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says the U.S. humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan shows that Washington would not fight on behalf of its allies.
But when people are coming to see this also, Biden says, and this is a lesson and a message to all the allies of America and the region, he's also defending himself. This is a very significant statement, a very, very significant statement, and I call on all the allies of Americans here in the region to listen to this. It is not our job that the U.S. troops fight on behalf of anyone. If anyone thinks that the Americans will come and fight on their behalf, then this is what Biden is saying. And in order for Biden not to fight on behalf of someone, he accepted a humiliating defeat and withdrawal in Afghanistan.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said the U.S.-led NATO mission in Afghanistan failed miserably. He noted that Washington's withdrawal from the country was not by choice, but was in fact the result of its inability to stay. Nasrallah said the U.S. failure in Afghanistan also demonstrates that Washington's regional policies are miscalculated and ignorant. Human remains have been found inside the wheel well of one of the U.S. planes that left Kabul airport in a rush earlier this week. The discovery was made after the C-17 aircraft landed in a base in Qatar. The U.S. Air Force says it is reviewing the circumstances surrounding the incident. On Monday, the world was shocked at images of thousands of desperate Afghans trying to board the U.S. airplane to leave the country following a Taliban takeover. Hundreds got inside the C-17 while some clung to the aircraft. Several people were killed in the chaos. Political commentator Sarah Flanders says the result of Washington's 20-year war in Afghanistan has been a complete ruin of the country.
We can see the U.S. is leaving Afghanistan in complete ruin, which, and yet they made enormous multi-billion dollar profit on this war. That is a crime on every level. Every step of this war for 20 years has been a complete lie that the U.S. ever intended to bring, had no interest in bringing democracy or rights for women or solving any of Afghanistan's problems. It was always about increasing U.S. domination of the region. They have been pushed back decisively. Their completely corrupt army couldn't even hold together. And we can really see that the misery of those at the airport who had cast their lot with the U.S. occupation and now are in desperation. And they have been thrown away like excess baggage. That's how they're being treated by, you know, U.S. officials. As they scramble onto the planes, they leave behind all of those that they used and abused.
The U.S. president's approval rating drops by 7% to hit its lowest level so far as Washington's two-decade war in Afghanistan ended with the rise of the Taliban to power. A national poll found that 46% of American adults approved of Joe Biden's performance in office. Biden's popularity dropped as the Taliban brushed aside Afghan forces and overran the capital, Kabul. The takeover marked the end of 20 years of U.S. military presence that cost trillions of dollars and thousands of American lives. Last month, Biden praised the Afghan forces for being, quote, as well equipped as any in the world. He also said that a takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban was not inevitable. Following the Taliban's takeover of Kabul, Italy's foreign minister has urged the West to seriously reflect on the mistakes made during the 20-year intervention in Afghanistan. Also, many geopolitical analysts have slammed the U.S. for its disorderly withdrawal from the Central Asian country. Max Civilli is in Rome.
On Tuesday, 24 hours after the first plane carrying Italian nationals and diplomatic staff arrived in Rome from Kabul, top officials from Italy's government expressed their opinions about the Afghan crisis. Prime Minister Mario Draghi stressed the importance of preventing terrorism from spreading and protecting Afghan civilians and those who worked with the international community. Separately, the head of the Foreign Affairs Ministry, Luigi Di Maio, called on Western countries to seriously reflect on the mistakes made during the U.S.-led occupation that went on in the landlocked Central Asian country for 20 years. Analysts and commentators have also been deeply critical of Washington and its allies.
Betrayal, that's all Afghans are left with. All of their expectations have been betrayed. The ethical failure comes even before the political one. After 10 years, the U.S. had finally killed bin Laden in 2011. Why did they stay in Afghanistan? To export democracy? In the interest of whom?
About 50,000 Italian soldiers were deployed to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, making Italy one of the countries most involved in the region, along with the United States, Turkey, Britain, and Germany.
It was on December 30, 2001, when the Italian military arrived in the area entrusted to them by the U.S., the quadrant of Herat, in the northwest of Afghanistan. The number of Italian soldiers killed since the beginning of the U.S. occupation is 53.
Also, about 700 Italian soldiers have remained seriously or permanently injured. The mistakes made by the U.S. in Afghanistan include handing government posts to sycophants or corrupt figures.
Italians were puzzled after US President Joe Biden's recent statements in which he admitted that the reason for staying in Afghanistan after Osama bin Laden's killing was not to rebuild the country, but to prevent other terrorist threats from arising there.
I have been very much disappointed by what both Biden and Blinken said about the drawdown. Biden's shift from nation-building to limited counter-terrorist strikes in Afghanistan is very hypocritical. Many of us were there to rebuild a ravaged country. I hope European members will finally work towards creating a European Union military force. It's the only way we can have our say on international issues.
Italy's foreign ministry has said it is now working on a coordinated international initiative in Afghanistan to ensure humanitarian flights and make sure to tackle the emergency in an organized manner. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran says its nuclear activities are fully in line with its commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the International Atomic Energy Agency has been supervising Iran's nuclear sites. He noted that Iran's reduction of its nuclear curbs has been done according to mechanisms within the JCPOA. Khatibzadeh said Tehran will fully reverse its remedial measures if all the signatories honor their commitments and the U.S. verifiably removes all its sanctions. This comes after the IAEA said Iran has made progress in its work on enriched uranium metal. Tehran says the process is aimed at producing a reactor fuel plate. 10 Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails continued their hunger strike to protest against their illegal administrative detention. Some of them have been transferred from jails to Israeli military clinics after their health condition worsened. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. A total of 10 prisoners are going on with their protests, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. According to their families, Israel is responsible for the lives of the hunger strikers, as many were transferred to jails' military clinics after their health conditions deteriorated, while refusing to allow even their lawyers to visit them.
We know that Mujahid was transferred to the Ramla military clinic. This means he's in a bad health condition. He has been detained over 1 year ago under administrative detention, while he was not tried in Israeli court and there are no charges against him. He decided to start an open-ended hunger strike after the Israeli authorities renewed his administrative detention for the third time. It is unfair.
Scores of Palestinians, including prisoners' relatives and friends, as well as prisoners' advocacy groups, protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, as well as with the sick inmates who face medical negligence by the Israeli prisons administration, while the health conditions of many of them have seriously deteriorated.
We are here today to send a message that the prisoners are not alone in their battle. We are their voice outside the jail. We are here to support the hunger-striking prisoners and to support the sick prisoners, as a number of prisoners' lives are in danger. On top of those sick prisoners are Ayad Harabat and Nasser Abu Hamid. We are demanding the Red Cross Committee to immediately act and save them because their health is seriously deteriorating.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice. It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Security forces in Indian-controlled Kashmir have attacked Shia Muslims, preventing them from holding a religious procession in the region's capital city. The event was meant to mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Islam's prophet Muhammad. Sayyid Ali Safi has the details.
Scores of Shia Muslims were injured and many more were arrested after government forces resorted to batons to file a mourning procession in the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir. The authorities had imposed strict restrictions and blocked several entry and exit points in Srinagar to prevent the traditional event held on the 8th Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar. Defying restrictions, hundreds of people, some holding flags, poured onto the streets at several places in the city center. However, police attacked them and fired several rounds of tear gas shells to disperse the mourners.
All our Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussain slogans.
The police also beat journalists covering the event. For the last 3 decades, the authorities have banned the traditional 8th Muharram and Ashura processions in the main city, citing security reasons. Despite repeated pleas by religious bodies over the years, the ban has not been lifted till date. This year, the authorities had initially hinted at lifting the ban, but later denied permission to take out the procession.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiri people have made it very clear that they will not accept the ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussein.
The authorities say that the procession stoke anti-India sentiments and pose, quote, serious security threats. But the people here argue that if the authorities can allow the annual Hindu pilgrimage that attracts over 500,000 people, why not Muslim processions? Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to 1527 AD.
It's been 32 years and the status quo is intact. Every year, mourners defy restrictions and get thrashed in return. Religious bodies have strongly condemned the use of force against the peaceful mourners and termed the ban as a blatant breach of religious freedom and demanded its immediate withdrawal. Sayyidina Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به وقت حالا.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. In today's program, we'll be listening to Imam's expose of the enemy's plots to separate other colonized countries from their indigenous culture and make them dependent on the West or East. Please stay with us. During the post-Second World War years, because of the formation of the bipolar world order and a new equation known as the Cold War, nearly all countries were forced to be a member of either the Western or the Eastern Bloc. The Western Bloc was led by the United States of America, and the Eastern Bloc was led by the former Soviet Union. Concurrent with the intensification of anti-colonialist struggles throughout the world, a number of Asian and African countries decided to adopt an independent policy, to get rid of the two blocks of power. Iran was among the pioneers of this approach. With the nationalization of the oil industry in the country, the hands of Britain were cut off from Iran's oil reserves. This measure turned into a role model for other colonized nations to follow. In fact, in 1955, the first conference of Asian African countries was held in the Indonesian city of Bandung to set up the new bloc known as the Non-Aligned Movement. Iran's representative in the Bandung Conference in Indonesia was Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. His adopting of a negative balance policy showed a practical pattern for freedom seekers in the world. After the British-American coup d'etat in August of 1953, Iran's despotic Shah changed the foreign policy to complete dependence on the West, especially the United States of America. As he owned his throne to the Americans, he became an official member of the Western Bloc and granted myriads of concessions to Washington in the economic, political, and military domains. Hence, the despotic Shah created an atmosphere of suffocation and dictatorship in the country. The Shah destroyed people's civil freedoms and changed the constitutional rule to authoritarian and despotic kingdom. Thus, no opposition group or no opposition voice was allowed to be active in the country. While Iran was ruled by the dictatorial Pahlavi regime, Imam Khomeini staged his unique revolution to revive Islam and bring back the country's independence and dignity, which had been trampled upon by Western regimes, particularly the United States. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, succeeded to turn independence into one of the main axes of the Islamic revolution's discourse, through the motto, "Neither East nor West, Islam is the best." Hence, this slogan became the guide for Iran's foreign policy. Of course, this motto doesn't mean to sever relations with other nations. Rather, it means to sever all colonialist ties with the blocks of power and keeping the national sovereignty through reciprocal respect for other nations. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to emphasize on this principle throughout his life. In his testament, too, he referred to the enemy's efforts to destroy national self-confidence and make them colonies of the big powers. Imam Khomeini wrote, "Among the schemes that unfortunately had a great impact on countries and our dear country and its impacts have remained to a great extent is to make the colonized countries alienated with themselves and make them westernized or easternized. Thus, they trivialize themselves and their culture and power, and considered the West and the East as superior race, deemed their culture as loftier and the two powers as the Qibla of the world, and called dependence on one of the poles of power as an inevitable obligation. The story of this sad thing is long, and the blows that we have received by it and are still receiving are fatal and grinding. And what is more doleful is that they kept the oppressed nations backward in everything and brought them up as consumer countries, and so much scared us of their own progress and satanic powers so that we dare not to embark on anything and have surrendered all we have to them and have ceded our fate and our countries to them and are totally obedient to them." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, believed that blind imitation of the West or the East and passivity against foreigners are the most important impacts of dependence upon them. He wrote in his testament, This artificial absurdity and empty-headedness has caused us not to rely on our thoughts and knowledge in anything, and simply to imitate the East or the West blindly. Even if we had any innovation in culture, literature, and industry, the Westernized and Easternized would castigate and ridicule them, and they repress and disappoint our native thought and power, and through speech and writing, promote foreign customs and traditions, no matter how mean and scandalous they are, and sell them to nations by extolling them. I recommend the dear nations sympathetically and humbly that, now that they have been relieved of many of these traps to a great extent, the deprived generation is ready for activity and has stood up. We saw that many factories and advanced tools such as airplanes and other industrial goods, which were never thought to be put into work by Iranian specialists. We had extended all hands towards the West or East so that the specialists and experts would launch them. But due to economic siege and the imposed war, our younger generation themselves have made the needed parts and supplied them at lower cost and met the demand. The younger generation have proved that if we want, we certainly can. You should be watchful, wakeful, and careful so that politicians who are dependent on the West or the East may not drag you towards these international plunderers via satanic schemes, and stand up with firm will and perseverance to remove dependence.
Food for thought. Salam and condolences to you on the 8th of Muharram, when the Prophet's household was deprived of water from the river Euphrates by the enemies of humanity in a vain effort to force Imam Hussein, peace upon him, to endorse the illegitimate rule of the godless Yazid ibn Muawiyah. The martyr of Karbala's answer is indeed food for thought. By Allah, I will never give you my hand in allegiance like a man who has been humiliated, nor will I flee like a slave.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio and the program Islamic Laws, in which we are going to talk about the rules and fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei, which are related to the month of Muharram and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Before everything, let me express my condolences to the Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and all the Muslims all around the world, especially the Shias, on this being the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Like always, we are joined by our dear guest, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, salamu alaikum, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Salamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
So as I mentioned, today we will answer to the questions asked from the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the Supreme Leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
SubhanAllah.
Welcome back. You are listening to Islamic Laws from IRIB English Radio. Sheikh Jawid, today's first question is about mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and also saying the prayer on time or in the early portion of the time. Let me give you an example. For example, on the day of Ashura, people are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before the noon adhan or noon call for prayer. Or on the night before Ashura, they are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before adhan al-Maghrib, before, at the time in the afternoon and before the sunset. And then they hear the call for prayer, for like noon prayer in the day of Ashura or the night prayer on the night before Ashura. Now the question is that which is more important, the congregational prayer offered in the early portion of the time or continuing with azadari and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? And I think it happens a lot. I mean, this is a question for many Muslims mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, especially the Shia. As I mentioned, the best example is the 2 days of Tasu'a and Ashura, the 9th and 10th of Muharram, because from early morning people are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and then they hear the call for Zuhr prayer. Or we can think of the night, every night of Muharram, some people begin mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam before sunset, and then they hear the call for Maghrib prayer. Now the question is that which one is better, to continue with azadari or stop that and say the prayer on time?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, of course we do know that congregational prayer is a prayer which is offered in congregation. It's a wajib prayer offered in congregation, and
salat is obligatory. Congregational prayer is recommended.
Yeah, the prayer itself is wajib, but the congregational prayer is recommended. And of course, generally speaking, praying or offering prayer on time is more important, and precedence should be given to offering prayer on time. Now, to compare congregational prayer with azadari, of course, the religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, are of the view that we should give importance and precedence to offering congregational prayer on time. See, because it's wajib, it is obligatory, mm-hmm. and we have to give importance to an obligatory act rather than recommended act. Azadari is not wajib. No one considers azadari or mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam to be obligatory, but it is highly recommended, of course. So, as you rightly mentioned, this is one of the frequently asked questions, and of course, such incident does take place in different countries. Especially, I believe this event takes place a lot in the Indian subcontinent, because as far as I know, such coincidence takes place. Just as you said, the prayer, the congregational prayer goes on, and at the same time, an azadari or a majlis is expected to be held. Now, which one to be given more importance? Obviously, the congregational prayer has to be offered first, and then, of course, the azadari should be continued. And if it is difficult to stop, of course, mu'minin can continue with their azadari. Because, for example, if azadari is already going on, and if you stop it, the whole ceremony, of course, will come to an end.
They need to, arrange it in a way.
The arrangement has to be important. In such a way that the azadari should not take place at the time of the wajib prayer. It has to come after it.
I work in the night with millions of stars.
I believe that it is shown by Imam Hussein alayhi salam himself on the day
you're
of
right,
Ashura.
You're right, yeah.
When one of his companions told him that this is the time for Zohr prayer, and the Imam prayed for him, and Imam Hussein alayhi salam stopped continuing the war, mm-hmm. and he began saying the prayer. And what is important is that Imam lost some of his companions during that prayer.
During that
so
prayer.
It shows the importance of that prayer.
You're right.
And alhamdulillah, we see that recently in these years, at least on the day of Ashura, we see that alhamdulillah, all the mu'mineen, they, you mentioned, arranged in on their azadari in a way that it finishes at the time of noon prayer. They say the congregational prayer, and then they continue mourning for Imam Hassan.
Right.
Now, on the same note, Sheikh Javid, some may ask that we see that some people, again, maybe especially the youth, they like to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam even late at night.
Mm.
And it causes some of them, because they sleep very late at night, then it they are sure that it will cause them somehow to lose morning prayer, if you may
You're
put
right.
it this way. And they are not able to wake up early in the morning, and it becomes qaza. So is it something, religiously speaking, encouraged for the youth to do that?
Well, it's absolutely forbidden to miss one's prayer. In the example that you gave, especially the young generation, the teenagers, who have attained puberty, they continue with azadari until late midnight, and then in the morning some of them miss their prayers. That's an unfortunate thing. You know, it's not permissible to let your prayer be lapsed or to be missed. You know, it's very essential to offer your prayers. And not to miss them. And also in this time around, you know, everybody has a mobile phone, everybody has access to an alarm clock
yeah,
which
true.
They can wind up and then so that the clock might ring him up and he can offer his prayers. So basically it's very important for every individual to understand the importance of prayer. The importance of fulfilling this duty and offering this and fulfilling this obligation. Prayer is the most important pillar, and of course, if prayer is not accepted, if prayer is not valid, then all other acts of worship will be affected. So if it's rejected, just as there's a saying from Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam and also Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, if prayer is rejected, all other acts of worship, such as fasting, such as azadari, and the likes of such things, will be rejected as well.
At the end of the day, we are talking about an obligatory action, like prayer and salat,
yes.
and a recommended action, that is mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So as you rightly mentioned, the preference should be given to the prayer. And I believe that, first of all, it is the duty of the scholars, especially those who have lectures during the month of Muharram, to explain this fact for the youth who are, their intention is very good, because they are going to show the love for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and they mourn for him. They love to mourn late at night, but this very important point should be, I believe, mentioned by the great Shia scholars, that they can have both. To mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam and not to lose the obligatory prayer.
Yes, yes.
And second of all, it's the duty of those, again, who arrange these ceremonies. They can arrange it in a way that, because you see that people like to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam like 1 hour, 2 hours, so they can start the program earlier so that they can mourn and have enough time to sleep also during the night and wake up for the following day.
You're right.
Sheikh Javid, unfortunately we are running out of time. Again, I would like to thank you for your presence in this program. And again, I would like to express my condolences for these sad days of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Inshallah, we will continue answering these questions in the following session. Till then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
The light.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludwig Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special, in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years. As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except there are scant references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed the bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels, to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This time figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Egypt's forgotten art of fabric is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of fabric over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can, because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now skillful artists in her workshop who design colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We make products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into an obsession for years to fill